Yes. Wow. Yes. How about that? Wow, a live audience.
Amazing.
This will be the biggest letdown in the VIF Festival. I'm pretty sure. 100%.
This is the part where I'll play the theme song.
So we didn't have that queued up, and we can bring it when we brought it north.
The theme song doesn't travel.
Okay. All right. Well, that's all right. We'll make it happen.
But this is the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am your co-host, Jason Snell. And across the table from me, not the internet, is your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman.
Hey, hello, Jason. Sir. How are you? How's everybody?
Pretty good. We are in.
You seem like we're in our like pajamas and our like shorty robes and shit like that. So check the box.
I gotta check the.
There's gonna be a lot of swearing in this.
I gotta check the box already. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, we're usually not wearing pants. That's the short version of it.
Yeah. And now we're semi dressed.
Sort of, yeah, we have some clothes on. So thank you for being here live at the Vancouver International Film Festival to listen to us talk about international films. Nope. Television. It's going to be a podcast about television because that's what we do every single week.
Every week. We're at number what? 10?
I don't know the number anymore.
But actually, we've been doing it for 10 years. So there you go.
I haven't. I was listening 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then
I was doing it 10 years ago.
You were.
Not very well.
At the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah.
But you moved on.
We've moved on. We actually told the story. If anybody was interested, well, I'm sure you're not, but I'm going to tell it anyway. That's the benefit of actually having the microphone. I'm going to lie to you or just tell you whatever I want to tell you. But 10 years ago, in 1997, we were the first podcast about television at any newspaper in the country, and we found that out in a totally roundabout way, where BBC Radio called us and said, "Hey, you're the first TV podcast in the United States at a newspaper," and we were like, "What? What are you saying? Who are you?"
Obviously, hadn't listened to the podcast,
no,
and realized you didn't really talk about television very much. But yeah,
true. And it just happened that way. We were doing it in the second floor of the, and even the San Francisco Chronicle didn't even know we were doing it. I was actually bringing guests in, and like Ricky Gervais and Ken Burns and a bunch of people. We'd get up on the phone, and then. And that was harder to do.
You called David Duchovny. That was the highlight.
Yes,
when you called David Duchovny, who was standing at his window looking out at a wildfire in Malibu, worried that his house would burn down. But he was talking to you on the phone.
Yeah, he was worried his house. Yeah. I was like, focus. Will you? You can afford it. It'll burn. If it burns down, you're going to get another one. Afford it. Oops.
Yeah, no, you're good. It's all good.
Feedback. But yeah, so that's how it started, and then we've had a couple of iterations, but the last 107 or so have been just Jason and I talking about television, so that's what we'll do today.
That's right. Well, it's an amazing time to talk about television because it is peak TV, although I read a story the other day where Netflix poo-pooed the idea that it's peak TV. The chief people who cause peak TV to happen said, "Nah, it's just choice. It doesn't matter that there are 500 different scripted shows for people to choose from. It's fine."
You know, they dropped 116 new TV shows. No, not new, but 116 TV series and movies last week on Netflix. So it's a lot.
Yeah.
So it's a lot. Yeah. And so a lot of those were new. Like, they just like, "Oh, we picked up a bunch of stuff." But if you look at it, like I have to do, and Dan Feinberg, also of THR, Hollywood Reporter, we look at what the new shows are coming up because we have to divide it up and review all the stuff that's scripted, and there's a lot, and Netflix produces a ton of stuff, so we're past peak TV.
Ted Sarandos at Netflix, while poo-pooing peak TV, also dropped the idea that although Netflix spent $6 billion
with a B
in content this year, no worries, next year they will spend $7 billion. So that's, you know,
it's kind of amazing. I always wonder, like, what other countries are thinking about when they like read stuff like that. They're like, "Wait, you're $7 billion on content just for Netflix? Like, that's a gross national product for
right."
Like,
I did read a 1% story.
1% of the
being in Canada, I did read that one of the things that Netflix is planning on doing is investing in buying Canadian content. And this is something that they've done in France before, this idea that they're essentially a de facto broadcaster, which means that in a lot of countries, there are some regulations about supporting the local television industry, not just importing American television, but doing local programming. And it sounds like that is now starting up for Canada for Netflix, too. And the nice thing about it is that then they will show those shows everywhere in the world.
Yeah, and I think they should do that. It's weird. I've been coming to VIF for, I don't know, 5 years now, I think. But there was 1 year when I met a lot of people who were in TV in Canada. And it was a really weird, because I'm all pro Canada. Like we're going to defect during this podcast. We're going to be here. I think if we do it live, we can be accepted. Like we want to.
It's possible. The internet knows no boundaries, right? So we can totally our podcast can defect in any
moment.
We're
going to defect. I love Canada, but I was talking to some TV producers in who were Canadian, and they were kind of like down on Canadian television, and they were up on American television. This was a few years ago. And I had found up some Canadian stuff that I thought was really good. And I was at the Banff World Media Festival this year and met a lot of people making really great stuff there now. So I was kind of all pro Canadian. And my kids are randomly totally into Letterkenny. And and when I told that to the Letterkenny people, they're like, so your kids are clearly stealing it because it's not available in the United States. And I was like, oops. Yeah. So anyway, I have that now that they're totally into that. But yeah, there's a lot of great Canadian stuff. And so it's a good stuff if Netflix comes and invests more money here. I think you guys do have the weirdest way to make television. Apparently, if you're in the business of actually making television in Canada, it's like there's insane restrictions and things you have to do. And it's really complicated.
But there's so much American television that's made in Canada. That's the interesting thing. Is that right. I was it's hard to make Canadian television in Canada. The people
right.
in Hollywood would love for Canada to send some TV productions down to Hollywood because they're so hard to make Canadian television in Canada. But here, I mean, I was thinking about it. The shows, great shows made in Canada over the years are currently being made. I know one of your favorites is Slings and Arrows, right? That's
loved
Canadian.
It. Yeah, Slings and Arrows is a classic.
So this
yeah.
is the part where we're just going to suck up to Canada.
Yeah.
It's just going to happen now.
Because we totally wanted to defect.
One of my great Netflix finds from last year is Travelers, which is Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
And then Netflix just sort of slid it on to Netflix for the rest of the world to enjoy, which is really great. I enjoy that show a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I was talking to somebody before we started about there's a lot of American-produced programming that is shot in Canada, but poses as being American.
Oh, all the time.
And there's this fascinating sort of like Stargate is a show about the Air Force that features a surprising number of Canadian Air Force personnel. It's I don't know how that happens. Orphan Black, of course, is set in New York. No, wait, it's Toronto. No, well, it's kind of New York. Well, it's kind of not. And then, of course, The Expanse and Star Trek. I don't know if you knew this, but space is Canada now, turns out.
Well, and Canada can be a lot of things, especially shooting everywhere.
Well, you know, the Stargate builders, they liked evergreen forests, it turns out.
Yes.
They always put their Stargates there. So.
Yep.
And the X-Files had a lot of cases in Seattle.
They
strange
did.
Strange.
Yeah.
How that
we
was.
Have a, and there's a, you know, it's funny because I've lived in San Francisco for a number of years, and it was like, in San Francisco, I'm like, nope. That's Vancouver.
Yeah, Monk
yeah.
is a good example of that, mm-hmm. where Monk had a lot of shots of San Francisco streets with mountains in the background. It's like, nope, that's not.
I am now an expert, by the way, in Vancouver architecture. So I can see like any stoop that you have. I can tell that that's not a New York stoop. That's a Vancouver stoop.
There's walking around the city. I can see X-Files especially, but Stargate a little bit too. Mm-hmm. Anything that looks vaguely futuristic has been used in a sci-fi show. If you have a building or like steps that look sort of strange in Vancouver, they have been in 10 sci-fi shows at this point.
Yeah, no
that's
doubt
just,
about it.
That's just how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did learn late that like if you're in the television business in Vancouver, you're doing episodic. But if you do movies, you're in Toronto, I guess that's the big difference. The movies are more Toronto yeah. stuff.
Although Orphan Black and Star Trek and The Expanse are all in Toronto, I believe.
Oh, see? I don't even know what I'm saying.
I don't know. So I have
once
to give
we defect, we'll figure it
we'll
all out.
We'll learn it all then.
Yeah.
I want to give full credit to Simon Barry, who I actually was in an elevator with him earlier. He's the creator of Continuum. He had the most clever way of dealing with the fact that he's making something financed by Americans but shot in Canada, which is he created this future where like Vancouver and the West Coast all kind of like broke off and joined their own country. And so it was still set in Vancouver, but it wasn't quite Canada. It's like, okay,
I love
all right,
it.
That's yeah. creative.
Yeah. That yes. Is,
that's right.
I love Simon.
Yeah, he was a perfectly nice person to be in an elevator with, I would say.
One of my first times at VIF, Simon said that he was happy that I was on vacation when one of his shows came out, and I didn't review it because he thought I was going to be super mean about it. And now I get along so great with him that I can't actually review any of his stuff. So he has Ghost Wars coming up on Sci-Fi.
You have to recuse yourself?
I have to recuse myself because we hang out too much because of VIF now. So that's it. So Dan will probably be reviewing that, or somebody.
And I'll just point out again, Canada, by the way, the only place in the world where Star Trek Discovery is airing on cable. Everywhere else, it is streaming. But
yeah, I don't get that whole HBO stuff up here either.
Les Moonves like sold it to Canada at some point. It's the Shatner effect. That's it. That's it. Yeah. William Shatner, Canadian, for those who don't know at home. It's true. Captain Kirk, Canadian.
Well, we love it. This is the great Vancouver edition because I'm a huge fan of this city. We don't have to keep sucking up to Canada.
We don't have to.
But I love it. Yeah, I love it. I come up here and as much as I can.
So one of the things we do on the TV Talk Machine usually is, just to give a little behind-the-scenes peek about how a podcast works, is we usually record on a Friday about 1 o'clock. About noon on Friday, I go to my web browser and go to The Hollywood Reporter and read everything that Tim has written in the last week so that I can ask him about it at 1 o'clock. So there's a full hour, well, I have lunch too, of preparation involved in
40
the podcast.
Minutes, maybe is what you're saying, 35 minutes of preparation?
Really 20. Yeah. So one of the things that I wanted to mention that you wrote this week that also dovetails, it turns out I mentioned in this story, which surprised me when I saw it.
Because I didn't tell you, yeah.
No, but so one of your great reporters, The Hollywood Reporter, did a nice piece about Apple. I've been writing about Apple for 20 years from a computer perspective, and Apple, of course, is getting into the television business. And they hired two production executives from Sony. And it's very clear that they're going to make an entry into scripted television. We've been talking about this on the podcast for a while now. And so there was a great reported piece in The Hollywood Reporter about this. And then you wrote an opinion piece about it, about the challenge that a company with so much money and clout and respect in their industry trying to kind of barrel into another industry. And when we were initially talking about Apple entering the TV industry, we talked a lot about that big checkbook, right? Like they were going to be
$257 billion in cash they have.
Right. They got the cash to spend as much as they need to launch a video streaming service if that's what they want to do, which it seems like they do because they hired the two guys from Sony to run it. And the point of the article and the piece that you wrote is there's one problem with this, which is none of these creators who are being buttered up by these now Apple TV executives, none of them can get an answer to the question of where will my show go when I make it? Because nobody knows what Apple's actually going to do with programming once they buy it. So what's the deal?
Well, the crazy thing of that was we did a story in June because right when Apple poached those two executives, I mean, it's totally inside baseball on some level, but we've been waiting for – people have been talking about Apple getting into the TV industry for a really long time. And when they do, you know it's going to be a revolution of some sort. I mean, you don't have $257 billion in the bank and wanting that perfection, that Apple perfection of everything without – but they've been – a lot of missteps and they've poked their toe in it. And like, we were just kind of poo-pooing the idea. And then their first two unscripted things were kind of half-assed and not very good. And Carpool Karaoke, I love it, but it was late, it was delayed. It was an inauspicious start for them. But when they got those two execs, we were like, okay, it's going to happen now. And so in June, we did a podcast and I did a column. Basically, like Jason often says that, and he does this sometimes when he's writing tech stuff, we talk it out. Like our version of prepping for a story is we do a podcast and we just talk about ideas and then you kind of get it in your brain and then you write it. And so after our podcast, I wrote this column about Apple getting into the business. And I thought it was funny because we thought it was a really huge deal. And THR people were like, yeah, that's kind of interesting. And then like within weeks, like Wall Street Journal, New York Times, everybody had done pieces, and it was getting bigger and bigger momentum. So our joke is like, yeah, we did that in June. And then Lacey for THR did a story last week about this whole thing. And her saying that we both read the column, or her reported piece, like, and to have someone on the record saying, and how it works in Hollywood is like, you're represented by people and you go in these meetings. And so she talked to somebody from an agency who represents a lot of people and said, yeah, our people are coming out of that meeting and they're saying, we don't know what's going to happen if they give us all that money we want, which is in their bank. We don't know. It would be great to have it, but we don't know what's going to happen when I make my show. Where does it go? Like, what happens to it? I mean, you make a show for CBS. You know it's coming out on CBS or Netflix. And so they didn't know. But we thought the funny thing was, like, we knew this in June. Like, we guessed at it. It's not, like, rocket science.
It is funny. You know, people get so cynical about Hollywood and about deal making. And they think that whoever writes the biggest check, that's going to be it. And the fact is, there is a little more to it than that. That there, the rise of Netflix and Amazon as companies, some of the clout that HBO has, like, some of it is beyond who writes the biggest check. It is who you know. It is, what does it say about me if my show is on FX versus HBO versus Netflix? There's a lot of intangible stuff there that, I'll grant you, if they write you a check that's twice the size, maybe you get over it. But if it's all kind of in the ballpark, these things come into play.
Yep.
And this is one of those really interesting areas where if you're a creator, like Apple, we talked about this in the podcast, Apple is going to approach big names. They've got these executives who are respected in Hollywood, and they got the big checkbook, and a lot of people in the creative field respect Apple as a brand and as a company. And they're going to approach them, and they're going to say, we want you to, we're going to give you creative freedom. We're going to give you a full series, season order. Make a show for us. That's all great, but there's this stumbling block, which is, where does it go? Like, how will people see it?
Right.
And if you're super cynical, you're like, why do they care? Like, they're going to make it and get paid, and maybe they don't care. But I think the truth is, they do care. Like, these super high quality creators, they do want their work to be seen. And Apple, if Apple has a strategy for this, they haven't announced it. They haven't told anybody because they're very secretive.
Right.
And so we're left in this really weird position where Apple is competing with Netflix. And Lacey's story says very clearly, like, Apple has bid for projects
and lost. I don't think we thought that was going to happen, and I'm sure they didn't think that was going to happen to them.
Right, but and then that's the question: is are they losing because they're not bidding enough? Or are they losing because the people involved are like, yeah, the money's about the same, and I know what Netflix is.
Yeah, exactly. So it does come down to that. You know, it's for us, we do a lot of, and for me especially when I write about the industry, it's all inside baseball. But to me, it's like, reviewing a show is like one thing. That's great. You finish product comes out and you watch it and you do it. But if you do 100 of those, you kind of lose interest in just reviewing it as a show or a movie or whatever. But the actual how the industry runs is so much more fascinating because nobody knows how it works. And everybody's got a shit ton of money and they just throw it around. And you're like, when you come into this, like, with you don't have to be a reporter. You just have to have a skeptical mind. You're like, so you really don't know what you're doing. Like, you don't, what? You know, and like, everybody comes up from, like, you think, you know, I think we're trained to think that they're all like super serious TV executives. They all started in like the mailroom. You know, no one really knows what there's no recipe for a hit, or else everybody would have one. So I love covering the industry. And this right now is like the central thing in the industry for me, because I think there's so much money with Apple. So we, in June, and Jason really led this because he knows so much about Apple. He's written about Apple for years. I call him the tech. You're like a tech genius. And so I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, certainly tech expert. And so we
you're like, a television genius, Tim.
That I already knew.
All right.
That I already knew.
Okay.
But no, I'm just kidding.
Just reinforcing.
But the sum of that column was like, he's like, oh, look, they're not going to put it on Apple Music. They only put
Carpool Karaoke and the Planet of the Apps.
Planet of the, right? And if you've ever seen Planet of the Apps, it's terrible. It's like fish. It's like
Well, it's Shark Tank.
It's Shark Tank.
Except the pitch happens on an escalator. You've heard of the elevator pitch. They have the escalator pitch.
They literally have an escalator.
Where literally it's you so are going, bad. Like Donald Trump declaring that he's going to run for president. You are on the top of an escalator, and as it slowly comes down, you have to tell people who are downstairs
Gwyneth
at a Paltrow. Table.
Right.
Here's what my app is going to be.
You have to have your pitch done by the time you get to the escalator.
Not,
it's terribly
It's
done.
Not, yeah.
And it's not that interesting, but Carpool Karaoke is pretty good. So that's their two shows, but they're put in. If you want to watch them, you have to go to Apple Music and pay your money.
Pay your $10 a month or whatever.
Yeah, and you'll get it. Well, we knew. I don't know if that's my feedback or your feedback.
It's the refrigerator.
Oh, nice. I love it. So,
hello, podcast. Enjoy this refrigerator sound.
So the But we knew that, like, in the future, they're going to have Apple Video. I mean, that's if they're getting into the business, they have to have Apple Video. They're going to charge you $14 or $11 or $9 a month.
Right. It's hard to believe that Apple would say, hey, Apple Music is great. If you get that, you get video, too. It's not impossible, but it seems
it's
to me
improbable.
Far more likely that they'd say, hey, everybody who's spending $10 a month on Apple Music, that's great. Thanks. You can also spend $10 a month on Apple Video.
Yeah, like, that's how they're going to make their money.
More money.
Plus, people who are into music. I love music. I also love television, but not everybody's going to pay for both, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to have a separate subscription services. It's pretty obvious to us. So why they're not telling people who are making shows for them? They're like, we're going to give you like, and people have a hard time. People, when you tell people how much it costs to make a show, unless you're in the industry, it blows your mind. You know, it's like, you know, $6 to $10 million to do a drama. You know, $2.5 to $5 million to do a half hour sitcom. The pilot, one of them. So that's a lot of money that's getting thrown around. And these guys have a lot of money, so you know, you want to know how it's going to come out. We're pretty sure it's going to be a subscription service. We don't know why that's a big secret. It's probably going to be Apple Video. But we also, one of the interesting things about it is, like, if anybody here subscribes to Netflix or any other thing, like there's a British service called Acorn, if you like that. There's BritBox, if you like that, right? They're all good. In the States, at least, you're going to be able to get AMC and FX without commercials. So this whole idea of skinny bundles where you don't pay your big cable bill and you just pick what you want, you know, like I want British dramas, I'll take that. And then I want Netflix and I want HBO. And then some people say, well, I want local sports, and you can somehow package that all together and hopefully it'll be less than you're paying for your cable bill. Well, Apple Video will be one of those at some point. We're pretty sure.
Yeah, it seems like. It's hard to imagine because they want their services revenue to grow, and this
right.
is how you do it. Is you
and
invest that money building a catalog and then you charge people monthly.
$15 a month. But like I'm somebody who has a lot of these services. I'm not going to pay Apple $15, and I love Apple on products, but I'm not going to pay them $10 or $15 a month if they have two shows or if they have three shows. So we were like thinking, like, and we joke a lot where we're like, okay, we know a lot about the industry, but you don't have to be that smart to understand that that's not going to work. So you have to buy somebody's library. And Apple has $257 billion in cash, and they frequently buy tech companies. So we know they're going to buy somebody. We just don't know who it's going to be.
So this was an interesting bit of speculation that you did, which I hadn't really thought of, which is, what do you do? Yeah, if you're Apple, you can't just go out and say, well, they could, because that's what CBS did, right? CBS said, hey, if you'd like to watch Star Trek, that will be $10 a month, which...
Which is asinine. Like, why would you pay $10 for one show?
It is kind of ridiculous. And as somebody who's doing it,
you can get
paying that money.
That is crazy. That is
asinine. It's ludicrous.
Only
an idiot.
I'm going to talk to your wife about that misspent money.
Only an idiot would pay $10 for Star Trek.
That's crazy time.
It's good. It's really good. But is it worth $10 a month?
No.
I know a lot of Star Trek fans, by the way, who are waiting. They're going to run 8 episodes through mid-November, and then it comes back in January, and they're all waiting for mid-November, and then they all buy 1 month, or they'll buy
binge
the free
it.
Trial. They'll buy the free trial, binge it, and cancel it. Yeah, that's totally what's going to happen. So this is the question: is like, how does Apple make it worth $10 a month? And does that mean writing? If they write a check, even if they write a check for several billion dollars for new stuff, the new stuff's going to take a year or two to come in, even to be like an HBO level of original content. And even HBO has a catalog. If you go on HBO Go or HBO Now,
decades worth of stuff.
They have a catalog of TV, and then they've got all the movies that come and go, right?
Yeah.
So what can Apple do? And your idea in the column was, well, you know, they make acquisitions all the time. What if they bought some streaming services and just kind of built, this is what they did with Beats, right? They bought Beats and they got the headphones, and they still make the headphones under the Beats brand, but they also got Beats Music. And that's what Apple Music is Beats Music. They just picked up that service, re-engineered a little bit, and then relaunched it. So they could, it's not just the catalog. They might actually even buy bits of the streaming infrastructure and the subscription infrastructure from Hulu or Acorn or BritBox or who knows what, whoever, who's for sale.
Right.
I mean, Disney has been rumored, which seems kind of insane that
Disney
Apple
Netflix,
would buy Disney or
happen.
Netflix. I mean, they've got a lot of cash, but I don't think that that
they don't have
happen.
Disney cash. That's
also, like, why would they hire the reality? Why would they hire two respected development executives and then buy a company that has its own development executives? It seems like that wouldn't be what they would do.
Yeah, but it's kind of exciting, I think, just from a kind of a again, inside baseball thing. It's like they're going to buy somebody. Maybe that somebody's Canadian. Who knows? You know, maybe it's Acorn, the British people who are probably like, yes, please buy us. Because, you know, everybody's owned by somebody. If you need to have content, though. So somebody has to buy it. You need a library for me to pay $10 or $15 a month. I want to know everything that starts. But it's not going to be Netflix. They'll never sell to Apple. It's not going to be Disney because you can't buy Disney. And besides, Disney's planning next 2019 to have their own streaming service.
Two
of them. One's for ESPN. Don't buy that. It's crappy. But the second one's going to be like Disney, Pixar, Star Wars. All that stuff's going to be together. I would pay money for that, especially if there's a Disney vault where you can watch old cartoons and classic stuff. Depending on the pricing, I would buy that. So really the future is going to be, what are these little things you're going to pick? One of these little skinny bundles you're going to pick up. But our point is, Apple doesn't exist unless they buy something, and they have the money for it. So now it's just a target. I think there's a possibility that they could go after Hulu, which would make a lot of sense, but you'd have to pay off all the owners of Hulu. There's like five different owners. Well,
what's really interesting is
owner.
Hulu was made. Yeah, sure. I got
part,
a piece
part
of Hulu.
Owner.
Well, I'm a subscriber, so does that count? Do I get equity for that? Hulu's interesting because it was a company that was made by the TV networks because they wanted to dip a toe into streaming, but they didn't want to fully commit. And now it sounds like all the TV networks kind of want to build their own thing. So it wouldn't surprise me, actually, that's a classic TV Talk Machine line, by the way.
Wouldn't surprise me.
If Hulu might not be a bad fit for Apple because it's got an existing business, even though it's got its own programming and all of that, but if the networks are like trying to escape it because they want to build their own things and not be in this weird kind of DMZ between all the different networks.
I think they're going to hear that line later, by the way, when we open it up to questions. Like, well, that's that.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Was my default line when I didn't know anything.
That's right.
When is that on? Could be Tuesday.
Yeah.
Wouldn't surprise me.
It's a day.
Like, literally did not
There's
know.
A one in
Do you think this is going to happen? I don't know. Like, wouldn't surprise me. But that'll happen when
So Hulu is in a weird place because, like, the world they were built for is not necessarily the world we occupy now. So,
and they just won the Emmy for Handmaid's Tale. Does anybody watch Handmaid's Tale? Yay. Yeah. And their other stuff is really good, too. It's just that it hasn't got it got noticed, and they're building out. They just picked up the guy running all their, they have a really good originals team, and they picked up, Joel Silverman from AMC, smart dude. And he's going to keep going. They have a really good team in place at Hulu. That doesn't mean that they would lose their jobs if Apple bought them, because Apple has a pretty small team at this point, but yeah, that could happen. Anyway, that kind of stuff's interesting to me.
Another thing that we should mention is Apple, if you look at its services, plays worldwide. And this is something that people in Canada know better than in America, that a lot of companies, Amazon, don't play worldwide. Like, you can't buy an Amazon Echo in Canada. Well, legally, you can pretend.
No.
And a lot of Amazon.
Anybody in this room want mine? I have it. I could. If I had known that,
just
I would have
chip
brought
it up.
One.
Yeah.
It is literally the worst product. Like, it's on all the time.
Wow.
And
wow.
I say that, you know.
Why you have to lash out?
I just, every time, I know you kind of like it.
I got like four of them.
See, every time I say something, usually something dirty, it like says, Alexa's voice comes on. I will look up, you know,
Something
slash
terrible,
porn,
yeah,
something or cartoon or like, and you're like, what? Oh, it's on all the time.
The microphone,
it's picking something up.
So my point is that Amazon, like, is in the UK and the US and kind of nowhere else. And most of Apple's services are in, they roll out over many countries.
Yeah.
And that's, an interesting challenge for them, but it's also potentially an advantage, is if they're going to do this video service, they may start it in the U.S., but certainly they're going to plan to roll it out in a lot of different countries fairly quickly, I would think. I mean, maybe it'll take them a year or two, but there are not that many of these services that play that widely. Netflix is everywhere, right? But and that's one of the reasons Netflix writes those big checks, is that a Netflix original is generally released, as we like to say, simultaneously, worldwide, just like this podcast.
Yeah.
And they can do that because they just, instead of selling the Canadian rights and the British rights and the German rights and all of that separately, Netflix just buys a show and says, yeah, it's ours. It'll be everywhere. And my friends in Scotland who subscribe to Netflix, they get it the same day I do.
Same day, yeah.
It's so civilized that way.
You know,
like,
what?
All TV should be that, like that.
I always tell people that, like, the downside, we should move away from, like, acquisitions because it's a little bit wonky and we could get into real TV shows. But, like, I always tell people that when I scroll through the stuff that Netflix offers, I'm like, I'd like to watch that. Oh, I'd watch that. Or you come to a documentary. Oh, I want to see that. I'm already paying for it, right?
Yeah.
But I have no time to see it yet. And one of the problems that Netflix is running into is that it's too much. And then people are saying there's too much on it. But that's their whole strategy. Because people will say, "What? You know, HBO is all about prestige. FX is about prestige. That's their brand. They want to be like, oh, no, we would never make that crappy-ass show. Ours is, like, totally intellectual up brand, right?
And Netflix is like, would you like to see Fuller House?
Yeah. And people are like, why does Netflix do that? And because, like, their business model isn't... I mean, they want quality. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think Ted Sarandos is actually brilliant. I think he's a really smart dude. I think the guys who built that Netflix are really smart about what people want and what they want to see. But big picture-wise, they're like... We're not a prestige brand. We don't 100% of our stuff. We just need 100% of everything.
Yeah.
Right. So that when you look at it, you're like, oh my God, there's a trillion shows here.
No,
I'll give you $10.
We
for
talk
that.
About a lot how you can literally, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you can go and see what's new and be like, I have literally never heard of half of these things, and their whole TV series.
Yeah.
Even as a TV critic, you're like, I have no idea that
never
that even existed.
Yeah.
Never heard of it, because there's so much and there's new stuff. They are buying. I think they bought 50 feature films.
Yeah.
So. There's a new movie every week on Netflix that you may or may not have even heard of, and sometimes they don't get reviewed because TV critics are like, it's a movie, and movie critics are like, it's on Netflix.
That's
and
weird.
it's super strange, and they fill it up, although some of that is that they have a complex because they know that everybody else is going to take their stuff off Netflix and launch their own streaming series, right?
Yeah,
so they're deathly afraid that they're going to run out of content if they don't make their own, so they're desperately making content in order buying all of this content so that when every TV network pulls their content off Netflix, you'll still have a reason to pay them $10 a month.
Yeah, and part of the reason we'll move on to more shows now and get more specific, but part of the reason we talk about skinny bundles and all this nonsense is, like, I always tell people, like, well, in a couple of years, that's all you're going to be doing. You won't have cable anymore. And they're like, oh, no, that's not. I'm like, no. You will stream everything.
Well, and it changes who you are. If you're a TV viewer, the challenge is that right now, it's relatively easy. It's still more complicated than it used to be, but it's easy to be a TV consumer. It used to be you just turn on the TV, and then you pay your cable bill. And we're entering an era where and people are going to rebel. People are going to get angry about it. Where, like, you literally have to shop for what services you want. And I believe there will be a shakeout, like, in 5 or 10 years, where, you know, everybody's going to launch their own streaming service, and then at some point, most of them will die because nobody wants to subscribe to 20 streaming services.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, if you're a TV viewer, you're going to have to make some tough decisions about, like, do I get the Apple thing? Do I get HBO? Do I get Netflix? Do I get Amazon? What do I get? And now there's this really good show that's on Hulu, but do I really want to pay for Hulu? And it becomes
or Epics.
It's much less. Yeah. It's much less passive.
Yeah.
As a TV consumer, you know, TV, this wonderful medium that you can just flip it on and lay down and turn off your brain and watch TV, suddenly is requiring this level of focus on how you acquire the content.
Yeah, it's like putting together, like, a team or something. I don't know.
Have my people tell me what that'll be a new here's a new website that somebody can start, which is
tell
like, what kind of shows do you like? Here's I'm going to make a bundle of
tell me how to bundle
services.
Bundle this for me.
Yeah,
I actually did that. We've talked about this on the podcast. There's a woman who was like saying, I'm paying, like, what is 200 and no $200 something a month for cable.
For cable, yeah.
And fix this. And we're like, all right, let's try to get this down. And it's like winnowing it down to everything that you could winnow it down, and we got it down to $75. Includes Netflix, includes HBO, includes local sports. Boom.
You can do it.
That's a lot of money saved per month, you know? For a lot of shows you don't really care about that you get on these free things. I'm not sure how it's all set up in Canada.
Yeah, but the challenge
once
is
we
every
move here, it'll we'll figure
we'll,
it out.
We'll figure it out, yeah.
But then the shows won't get made.
This is the challenge is everybody
that
when people talk about cutting the cord and how they're going to save money, the reality is the TV industry is going to get its money. So if you don't want to pay that money, well, they'll find a way. They won't either make the shows that you want to watch because they can't afford it, or they'll put it on a different tier and you're going to have to pay more for that. Your cable company is going to realize people are going to stop paying for TV, but they're still going to have to get on the internet, so they will raise their internet rates. Yeah. Like, there's all the money. They're going to get your
this
money.
This is depressing.
They're going to get your money.
This is insidiously depressing.
I know, but this is the future of TV. I'm a believer that in the end we'll come out with like four or five major players and it'll be less awful, but not for a while.
Well, we should switch this slightly towards VIF oriented stuff because
to content. Do you want to talk about content?
We'll talk a little content. How many people here watch Black Mirror? Raise your hand. Yeah. All right.
I'm glad you're still here and that you're not just staying at home weeping,
jumping off a bridge. Yeah. How many people watch? How about American Gods?
Yeah, I watched.
Great book.
Yes.
It's
did
a
you
good
think
show.
It was well done on the television? I say that because you're supposed to say yes now because tomorrow I'm going to interview David Slade, who's the producer of and directed the first three episodes. That's a VIF thing.
Yeah, they're going to screen.
There you go. Thank you. I love it.
They're going to screen episode one, right? Or
they're
going to
show episode one. Yeah. It's really, and I actually went back because I didn't read the book. And it was a very confusing, visually super interesting, which is great because I'm going to be interviewing David Slade, who's the director. But because I'm going to interview him, I went back and rewatched like the first four. And now it makes so much more sense. I think for book people, just definitely were at a disadvantage starting it because it was so geared to people who had read the book.
Yep.
But visually, that series, thank God we've already checked the box on the explicit because that series is completely fucked up.
Yeah.
Like visually just insane.
It's well, I mean, can you tell that Brian Fuller is involved? Like,
well, I think everybody who's involved in it has a sense of just being so out there. The stuff that they were able to take from the book. So first of all, by the way, if you're not coming to tomorrow evening's talk with David Slade, American Gods from Neil Gaiman was considered unfilmable. And that you could not do it. Oh, this is you are a hero.
The wine
Thank
has arrived.
Whoever did that was a genius. that it was unfilmable. And David Slade, British director, he did a lot of Hannibal. He's also done feature films. He's got a new short coming up. He was excited because I want to take that challenge on. And that's fascinating to because I don't know enough about being a director, obviously, that I could do it. Writers, I got that. I get a little sense of that. So one of the scenes, I don't know raise your hand. I know it doesn't work for podcasts when you raise your hand, but raise your hand so I can see. Who has seen American Gods?
Well, almost.
One, two, three, four, four,
stars
five.
Stars penetration is
yeah.
limited.
So, well, it, stars penetration is limited. I will say there's a scene where there's
except on Outlander, there's lots of penetration on Outlander.
Wow!
I already checked the box. It's fine.
You know what? There's I got to tell you, there's way more penetration on American Gods than there is on that.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
Yeah,
there's more. There's more dicks in American Gods.
Oh my
though.
God! There's so many more dicks in American Gods. Total full frontal nonsense.
Oh yeah,
but. There was a scene. They're talking about an unfilmable scene in the book, Neil Gaiman's book. There's an old god, and basically Queen of Sheba, and she devours her lovers, male and female, in the book. But in the book, she devours them back through her vagina.
Yeah, she seduces people and they have sex with her, and they are so ecstatic. I've read the book. They're so ecstatic that they don't really notice that they're being sucked inside her until they're gone.
So how do you film that? I mean, that's tomorrow. We're going to find the answer out when I talk to David Slade. I mean, I saw it happen. I was like, okay, that is really scary.
Somebody did a lot of storyboarding because it's kind of amazing how that is from a visual perspective, how that was shot. Yeah.
And then Is that who did it?
Well, no, Joel Murray was the first guy that got.
Oh, right. The first character.
Devoured.
Well, and a lot of them were. But so I'm fascinated how that kind of works. So he should explain that.
Yeah, it's I've read the book and I was very happy with the adaptation. I think they did a pretty good job. And it was something that I never really expected to see. That's the thing that blew me away is that it obviously had a visual sense to it. That when I mentioned Brian Fuller, because he did Hannibal, right? Like he's a producer who seems to have a real understanding that the visuals matter and that it needs to be, more, a lot of his stuff has very quirky, strange kind of visuals to them. Mm-hmm. And he knows that that's important. Yeah. And American Gods, you can see it. It's unlike any TV show you will see. It is super strange.
Yeah.
But good.
And we generally talk on the podcast about stuff that I have actually written that's come out. But something that's going to come out tomorrow and THR on THR is talking about, well, it's talking about my interview with David Slade, but it's also talking about this real, which I think is kind of fascinating because for people who watch television at all, if you film is a director's medium and television is a writer's medium. That's just how it is. But in the last 10 years, more directors have come over. And I'm not talking about like superstar film directors coming over. There's a lot of really great TV directors. And I also had to have this complicated paragraph that says we no longer need to differentiate between directors. You're a director. It doesn't mean that if you're a film director and a TV director, it's the same thing now, especially if you're doing cable and streaming services, high-end stuff. So we already know about, Scorsese and Soderbergh and Fincher and everybody who's come over from film. So that's not even a story anymore. The story is all the really great directors that are on television and how television, unlike film in a lot of ways, is really opening the doors to a much more diverse bunch of filmmakers. Much more. There's more minorities. There's a lot more women. The woman who won the Emmy this year she'd never even directed a pilot. She was a cinematographer, so it was her first directing a pilot. And she did The Handmaid's Tale pilot and won the Emmy. First woman to win an Emmy for directing a drama in 22 years. That's astonishing. Like,
we did a podcast about when they fired the director, Colin Trevorrow, off of Star Wars Episode 9. Mm-hmm. We did a podcast that was, we knew that they were going to pick somebody quickly, but we did a sort of like a draft of like who could direct it.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And so many of those people were Game of Thrones directors, Handmaid's Tale directors. It was like premium cable stuff where it's like, because honestly, like, how do you get somebody to do Star? I mean, they went back to J.J. Abrams in the end, but how do you get somebody to do something like Star Wars? You start to think about these high budget prestige cable TV series because they're the ones who are solving those same kind of problems. And especially for a franchise deal like Star Wars, that's the equivalent of being in the writer's medium, right? Where you're, as a director, you're not going to be able to have necessarily your vision of the script, but you're going to be able to innovate in terms of the visuals and the direction.
And two things that I think that are interesting about this whole trend, and my column is about, like, it's, yes, television is a writer's medium. It always will be because it's all about the story. It's less about the visuals. But now, especially the last 5 years, it's been a decade of really good directing, but certainly 5 years of astonishing directing across the board, multiple dozens and dozens and dozens of shows. So multiple directors. Old school directors who've been in TV for a really long time to, like, Pamela Adlon from Better Things. I don't know if anybody's watched Better Things. She's great. She has a really good eye. And Louis C.K. is like, you should direct. She's like, I'm just going to write this. I'm going to worry about writing this. She's like, no, you should really direct. She's like, I don't really know how to direct. She's like, it doesn't matter if you know how to do it. You do know how to do it. We'll give you the basics. And it turns out she's actually really good. And she's really different. And she, they follow that. I mean, just like Atlanta and just like Master of None, they follow that Louis, the Louis C.K. and the Louis series. The imprint was throw the book out on television. You don't have to follow the old rules. You can create a storyline that just drops. You can do half an episode about something and half an episode about something else. He basically just tore up the rules when he was at FX. So it's kind of fascinating that directors are now – so Pamela Adlon's really good. But if you look at the directors – so my column that's coming out tomorrow on THR is a little bit about David Slade. But it's also about like we need to rethink if we're going to talk about television as a writer's medium, because it's really becoming a director's medium because they're so good. And for the longest time, they didn't get credit and for what they did, which was essentially, not to be too wonky, they would really be hired. One director is hired. The person who made the most money was the first director. They come in, they create the template of the show, and every director after that follows that same template. You can't change it. You have to shoot it exactly like the original guy shot it. That's why he got all the money and you didn't. You get good money, but you're basically, you have to reinterpret in the same way what he did or she did. And, you know, now that's not how it is. It's like they're letting everybody reinterpret the show, the series, in visually in different ways. And at the same time, directors who come on are sometimes staying on for the end. I mean, Soderbergh did all 20. He shot all 20 episodes of The Nick, which is kind of really amazing if you think about it. And it's just all 20. I mean, hardly anybody watched The Nick. Trust me, I know that. But he did 20. He wasn't even he didn't even write it. He just shot it like every time. 20 episodes. It's pretty astonishing. So, you know, more and more times that's happening. And I just think that for television, it's going to be the directors are going to get their due. That's basically my long-winded way of saying that's what tomorrow's column is.
Well, the truth about the way the film industry is working now is it's so bifurcated, where if you've got a big budget, you've got a huge franchise.
Yeah.
And otherwise, the budgets are small. And there's very little left in the middle. Like, the middle has been kind of hollowed out of the film industry. You either get a huge budget or you don't, and that's about it.
Right.
And at that point, you could argue if you've got a big budget franchise, it's the same process as you go through with TV, which is that you are working with a writer's room and a bunch of producers who are going to have their say, because you're not just making a movie. You're making a Marvel movie or a Star Wars movie or a Disney movie or, you know, whatever, a James Bond movie. And so who's qualified to make those movies is like the TV directors,
yeah,
in some ways. So the way you get, it seems like this is the pattern now, is you make an indie film and then you go and make a TV show.
Right.
And then maybe you get brought up to right, make a Marvel movie or a, well, like the most successful Marvel movie directors of the last couple of years are the guys who did, the Civil War, and they're doing the Avengers movies.
Right.
And their credit prior to that was Community.
Yeah.
They did the paintball episodes of Community.
Sitcom, an NBC sitcom.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing. Yeah, it is a great episode.
Yeah,
yes,
sure.
You are so right.
But the Russo brothers, that was their imprint, and then they went from there. So this is, I'm sure Reed Morano from Handmaid's Tale is, you know, she's going to be up there for consideration.
How amazing is she? I mean, like, she had never even done a pot. No one had given her a, I mean, there's so many angles to that story. It's like being a woman, and it's like she's the youngest cinematographer. And she's not 19 or anything, but she's still pretty young. The youngest, like, a cinematographer, and she was nominated already for Divorce on HBO in this last Emmys. But she was also nominated as a director for The Handmaid's Tale. No one had ever offered her a pilot to direct, and they did it, and she wins the Emmy. She just killed it. I mean, like, I love right now that the TV industry is like, it's like completely opening up. They're like, oh yeah, and like no one thought Aziz Ansari could direct. They're like, okay, you're like the crazy guy, you know, you're on Parks and Rec, you're the guy who comes in and does the jokes, but he's deeper than that. And it's like no one thought that Louis C.K. could direct a thing until FX gave him a couple $100,000 and said, go away. It was what he wanted to do. Go away, make it, cut it, edit it.
Yeah, he literally edited it on his laptop.
Yeah,
himself
did the music. He still does that. He still does music. His credits are weirdly whatever. But I think what we're saying is that television is so much more creative than film. I think that's what we're saying at a film festival.
Yeah,
we're saying that. Right. Yes.
Well, I mean, I think it's not the fault of film as a medium, right? It's the fault of the economics of film, where if you're not... So a friend of mine...
It is an economics. And we're going to find out why we're here at VIFF. Certainly, I'm going to do it as I walk around to find out really good films while I'm here.
I mean, a friend of mine had his graphic novel adapted into a film. And he experienced this bifurcation too, because that was when they got the funding, it was essentially a low-ish budget film.
Yeah.
And it got marketed as a big budget film because the research said that it could be profitable that way. But, you know, they had a limited amount of money to make it because, and the people who made it because they wanted to work with the star and the director, basically. And that's the reality of film right now, is that even if you've got not just an art film for a few million, but like an action movie, above a certain point, it can't get made because that's the realm of the franchises, basically. Yeah. And so TV, we talked about peak TV. We talked about hundreds and hundreds of TV series. Like, where's the money?
Yeah.
And
it's in Apple. It's in Apple's vault.
Apple has all the money. It's in their mattress.
Tim Cook's
mattress is where it all is right now.
So I haven't done that much this week. So we could there's nothing new. I did circle back.
We should talk about Larry David.
Did anybody watch Curb Your Enthusiasm on Sunday?
Yes. You know, like, it's not just Will and Grace that came back. Curb Your Enthusiasm came back.
It is really good. And people were, I know that some people said, oh, it seemed like it was a little stunted and a little, it's like, go back and watch the other. There was always like that.
In 6 years, you've forgotten what Curb was like.
You know what? I was prepping to do this review, and they didn't send, you know, when you're in your ninth season, you don't have to send critics reviews anymore. So I had to watch it, watch it live, but I got the East Coast feed, so I got to watch it at 7 o'clock on Sunday and write this review. And it's like, you knew it was just going to be half an hour. Who knows? But it's just going to, we just want it to be the same thing, basically, with Larry. And that's what it was. It was very funny, very weird, very wincing. It's that wince-inducing humor. I thought it was back. People were like, oh, they seemed a little forced. I'm like, go back. That's what I said. Go back and watch the other episodes. The whole thing is forced. Like, the whole thing is just like basically one joke played over and over again.
All right. So, and to be fair, he waited till he had an idea.
Yep.
And then he came back, which maybe Louis C.K. will do that one day with Louis.
He will.
Maybe. In 12 years.
Let's turn it over to people to ask questions.
Normally, this is the point where I have hastily compiled emails and tweets from people who listen to the podcast and read them, and then we fail to answer them most of the time. But instead, since we have a studio audience, it would be appropriate.
Sure, why not? Somebody has questions.
Anybody have questions that you want to ask us?
You can just shout them out. Do it.
Sure. Since we're at a film festival, in an era of peak TV where it's not just numbers but quality, do you find that your movie watching habits have changed? Are there different kinds of stories you look for in movies compared to TV? And has that changed with the way TV has changed?
That's a great question. I don't get to watch much TV, much film, because there's too much television. The one thing that I teach a class on television at an art school in California. And the one thing I tell them is that my goal is to ruin their movie watching experience. Because that's bad to say at a film festival. But, you know, you only have like 2 hours. And I love when people are like, oh my God, that movie was 2 hours. Like, it was a chore. I'm like, that's nothing. You know, it's like, so I always say that because you have to do shorthand in a film, I want to teach you to know when the shorthand comes. Because in television, you have 10 to 13 hours on a cable drama to see something. And then they don't play their hand. They don't do as many red herrings. So for me, when I get to see a film, I just like to see stuff blow up now. I just want to be entertained. But when I actually see, like, smartly blown up, like the Bourne films, I'm okay with that. Or Atomic Blonde. I loved that film. Like,
thank you.
That was so much fun.
You have just plugged my friend's graphic novel adaptation.
I loved it. I could watch that 10 times. It was smart enough and it was action packed. But like, what I don't like is when I go see a movie and I'm like, okay, that guy's the killer. Because and I'm not saying this to like, I'm not even making this up, and I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm almost always right. Because it's like, there's so many shortcuts, and then they have to give you that little tick. Somebody does a little tick, and you're like, okay, that's the killer. That's it. So that is television and its long-form storytelling, and a little bit more sophisticated because it can tell a longer story with better-drawn characters, has kind of ruined my film stuff.
You know, Gene Siskel used to refer to that as the law of economy of characters, that in a film, when you only have 2 hours, there's literally only four people who could be the killer.
Right.
And it doesn't take very long for you to figure out which one it is, because you know it's not them, because that's obvious. Yeah. So it's got to be the other one.
Yeah.
And it always is.
Also, I'm the worst person in a movie theater, because I'm like, somebody is, I'm like, oh, that dude did it. Everybody's like, shh. I'm like, I can see one movie a year, and I already know who did it. So
I have a weird answer to that, which is, as a longtime TV viewer who goes to some movies but not a lot, what has changed in the last 5 or 10 years is I watch movies like television now. I mean, and I think a lot of people do that. I think that's the reason Marvel's success with the cinematic universe, which has spawned everybody else trying to do the same thing, and that's going to continue, as the Simpsons line goes, until it becomes unprofitable. the fact is, so many of the movies I see now are installments in franchises, right? I will go see the Star Wars movie every year. I will go see 2 Marvel movies every year. When we went and saw Wonder Woman, they're all kind of part of a product line now, and they're good. They spend a lot of money on them. They're good. They're well, the ones that are well made. But it is less often that something, I mean, mentioning Atomic Blonde, that the beauty of that is that was made as kind of a semi-indie movie, and then the studio was like, oh my God, Charlize Theron is great in this. We should actually put money behind it, and more people saw it. But like, it's rare that you see a movie like that that's not very small, yeah, or very huge. And so, yeah, in a sense, my movie going has been co-opted, and I treat it more like installments in a TV series where they release 1 or 2 of them every year, like the Marvel, or 1 every year like Star Wars.
And but that said, for my thing, I don't see a lot of like smaller indie stuff. So when I get to a film festival, usually it's something that's a little bit more atmospheric. It's like more like a poem, and I love that, because then you don't get to be tricked, or I don't get to see who the killer is. It's a feeling rather than a completely narrative story. And then it can impact me like a picture, or the visuals impact me, or like a poem would impact me. And I like that better. So those kind of films, I definitely want to see. I don't want to see Hollywood films unless it's like Atomic Blonde, right, or a bunch of shit blows up. Basically, because otherwise I know who did it. So
I want to praise Netflix too, because the fact is, in this era where so much less money is coming into movies, the fact that Netflix is spending money on 50 movies a year, the fact that some of these streaming services find value in standalone film properties instead of just plowing it into more series is good, because those are films that might never be made, never be distributed otherwise. And I've seen some really adorable small films that have just floated up on Netflix.
Yeah, that's good too.
I wish they could promote them better, right? I think surfacing content on these streaming services is really hard,
yeah,
but I've seen some good ones. And the other one I'll put a plug in, since I went to journalism school and everything, documentaries. Netflix, yeah, has done a great job, yeah, with documentaries, which basically don't get made and don't get seen. And Netflix,
yep,
makes a point of surfacing documentaries and paying money for docs. And thank goodness they're doing that, because nobody else is.
Yeah, and just quickly on the doc things, I was running through what's coming up in October. The number of documentaries that are new on Netflix right now, it's unbelievable. It's definitely double digits.
My daughter is taking a...
she's in October.
She's in high school, and she's taking a class where they're making a doc.
Excellent.
And one of their assignments is to watch docs, and I started diving into the doc section of Netflix, and I was like, oh my God.
That's one of their pluses.
They have done a really great job. So...
Yes. Good point.
Yes.
So one of the questions that you guys were talking about today is, how is Apple going to get enough content that people might pay $10 a month on their streaming service? And when they suffered the same problem for the music world, what they said is, well, for $10 a month, we'll just start streaming you basically all the music that we were previously selling. So what's the economics behind Apple potentially just launching the Apple Video streaming with a streaming bundle of all the stuff that they currently sell on the Apple TV store, which is lots and lots of content?
Well, they wouldn't have the rights. Yeah, that's the thing. Everybody else owns the rights to those. Apple only has the rights to sell them individual episodes. They wouldn't be able to...
Right. They could do it, but what it would mean is that they would basically be like, every TV episode, every single person watched, they'd have to pay the a la carte fee back to the studio, which is would be... They don't want to pay $2 back for an episode, right? They want to pay 10 cents or something, yeah, for streaming, would be the music analogy.
Starting it from scratch, basically.
Yeah. And I think they will... in to a certain degree, because when I mentioned about HBO, it's like not even HBO has no catalog except originals, right? Like HBO, Hulu, and especially Netflix and Amazon, they've got a back catalog. So I feel like if Apple's going to do this, it's highly unlikely they're going to say, well, we've got two shows or four shows, but it's going to be the same price as HBO. I feel like they're going to have to make a movie deal with a studio, and they're going to have to. I mean, there's a lot of TV stuff that is on everything. It's on Amazon and Netflix and Hulu, and those are the ones that are the easy gets. Maybe they make a special deal with somebody where they pull some stuff that is not available everywhere. Or maybe they do something like buy Hulu, in which case they would get those deals. But I feel like they're going to have to spend that money. But they will, because they're going to need a catalog. It's just, I mean, only Les Moonves at CBS would have the gall to charge somebody $10 a month for a single TV show. I don't think Apple's going to go that way. They want to be stronger than that.
Yeah, and half of our thrill about this is just like spend the money. Like when I want to spend money all the time. Like I want to go buy things. Like I'm a buyer. And so, like, I'm like, you have the money, buy some shit.
Well, that's what I want. I predicted this on the podcast a while ago, and it's still true. I'm going to say, by the end of the year, at least one, it's probably going to be multiple, some famous creator that you know and whose work you love is going to make a deal for an exorbitant amount of money where Apple's going to write one of those checks with their iPhone money, and they're going to lock somebody up. And the interesting thing is it may even be like, they've locked this person up to make a show. Where will it go? Nobody knows. But it's totally going to happen, because they're serious about it. I mean, they didn't hire those guys to sit in Culver City at these special new Apple video offices and like look out the window. They hired them to buy shows from creators.
They could pay Woody, like Amazon paid Woody Allen $80 million for six episodes.
I'm going to predict that they're not going to do something that dumb.
That is crazy dumb. $80 million. Did you watch that? I watched all six of those episodes. So they weren't worth $80 million. You know, I can tell you that.
I had not seen this number before, but apparently Netflix is going to pay David Letterman $2 million per episode for his interview series on Netflix.
That's crazy. I don't know where this money comes. Are they printing it in the back? Or like illegally? Like just like a roller? They roll it off? We'll find out.
Definitely gives you the art for commerce versus art for art.
Yeah.
You say you want to buy things, then you're complaining about your subscription, so that you're not investing in future content.
Exactly.
I do think, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, but I am charmed by the fact that some creators in Lacey's article in The Hollywood Reporter, that some creators, once you've reached the level where everybody wants you, everybody wants to be your producer and bankroll you because you're a fabulous TV and movie creative force and we love you, right? Once you're at that level, I feel like you have the luxury to sort of like pick where you want to be. And yeah, you could buy a nicer house, a nicer vacation home on the Mediterranean somewhere if you made the deal.
Or Vancouver.
For the bigger check.
It's very expensive here.
But it is expensive here.
Woody Allen could buy here.
But when you're at that level, I think I find it kind of sweet that at that level they actually care of like what's the home for my thing going to be, and that they might be reluctant to make that deal with somebody who's not going to give them wide distribution. Like, I think Netflix at this point has this great advantage of saying, we have hundreds of millions of subscribers worldwide who will get it the day that you want it out.
Yeah.
And Apple doesn't have a story there.
No, they don't.
They might. I mean, Vince Gilligan famously wasn't happy that his show was sold to AMC. That, by his words, was playing reruns of Short Circuit.
Right, yes.
So, I mean, you know, you had AMC acquiring shows like Mad Men and, of course, Breaking Bad. And now everyone would want to be on AMC. I think Apple may do the same thing.
I think that's their goal, but they got to get there. And the challenge is they're not going to have a channel sitting on everybody's cable package that they can tune into. They've got to convince people to pay $10 a month or something to get the shows. And it's
the prestige of television versus film. I mean, still filmmakers, I mean, look at the big uproar about Amazon at Cannes this year and Netflix as well. And so I think it's apples and oranges. I believe exactly what you're saying on it from a television perspective and streaming services and the prestige of Netflix versus others. But when you're looking at film festivals, that filmmaker still wants to premiere at Cannes or at Sundance.
Right, yeah.
And there's still that festival run, and I don't know if Apple will be able to be a competitor.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't forget, Apple has every device in the world.
Yeah,
it's true. Although that is one of the questions that I think is one of the reasons why Apple doesn't have a story to tell those creators right now is that I suspect the reason we don't know where Apple's going is because Apple doesn't know.
Yeah.
Because Apple is debating. Well, if you're Apple, what matters more to you? Is making $10 a month from everybody more important than selling everybody an iPhone? Because they could roll out Apple Video only on Apple TV and iPhone and iPad and Mac. Or they could roll it out everywhere. Like Apple Music's on Android. I don't know if anybody actually uses it on Android, but it is there. So that's a question that I suspect they maybe are still arguing
about
inside Apple, which is you cut off a certain amount of audience if you're paying creators in order to try to drive people toward buying Apple TVs for $160 instead of an Amazon Fire TV for $70.
I value those same devices, right?
So this is the question: is what business model do they want?
I think they should just say we will debut your show in every Apple store.
Those screens are really nice in those Apple stores.
It's a beautiful screen. You want to look at one of the screens, it's going to have your show on
it. And we'll do the red carpet premiere at the Steve Jobs Theater in Cupertino, which is a really nice theater, let me tell you.
All right, we need to wrap this up. So you are in charge of doing the wrap-up. You know
how to
do this.
Okay, well, I want to thank everybody here at the Vancouver International Film Festival for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And I want to thank our spectacularly wonderful live studio audience.
Yes, how about that? They actually sat through this. I'm convinced they were told something else was going
to
happen.
Yeah, this is all a scheduling conflict. We are supposed to be the director of American Gods.
Yes. Tammy says they were told there was free alcohol. There is the answer.
Well, that's
to this
why
turnout.
That's why we're here. So that's fair.
That's why we're here too. So that's perfect.
Yeah. If you would like, you in the audience or anybody at home would like to contact us, the best way you can tweet at us at TVTM. You can email us podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. I am Jay Snell on Twitter. Tim is Bastard Machine on Twitter. You can read Tim at The Hollywood Reporter. THR.com is very few letters to type.
Very few letters. And there'll be a whole story about VIF tomorrow.
And click on my favorite part of the nav bar on THR.com, which is sites, under which you'll find the Bastard Machine site.
Yes.
Which is not a site. It is a list of things Tim has written.
We end on an inside joke where I tell them, like, why don't you just put me under the TV bar? That would make sense, since I'm the chief television critic. Why am I under something called sites? If you click sites, I think I'm going to go off somewhere else.
It's because you're special. That's why.
Then they didn't give me an answer. They just said, shut up.
That ends our live edition of the TV Talk Machine podcast. Until next time, when we'll be back across the internet from one another. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yay.
Goodbye.